Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
All right, welcome. This is The Buzz on Technical Rescue. I'm Bob Duma, your host for today's program. Recording today's session live at Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, Maryland. For our topic today, we're going to talk about 10 years later, terrorism preparedness and response. Pleased to have joining me today, Rich Bowers, Fire Chief from the Montgomery County Fire and Rescue Service in Maryland. Welcome, Chief. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Thank you very much. A pleasure to be here and certainly an honor to be here. About 35 years in the service, I've come up through the ranks, served in every capacity, and had the fortunate opportunity to be the fire chief of a combination department, which is extremely large, about 2,000 people. I was also one of the, what we call the Dirty Dozen people in Montgomery County that started the Maryland Task Force 1 team with Tom Carr, and been a member of the USAR team on numerous deployments, Oklahoma City, as well as the Pentagon, and many other deployments in between there. So thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Thanks for joining us, taking time out of your day, Chief. Also with us is Mike Daniel, a firefighter with the City of Elizabeth, New Jersey Fire Department. Mike, thanks for being here, and how about a little bit about your background?
It was a pleasure to be here, Bob. I'm a fireman for about 15 years now, both in the career and the volunteer side. Many years ago. I'm a rescue specialist from Jersey Task Force 1, specialized rescue column moderator for Firehouse, as well as a columnist, and on a rescue company back in Elizabeth, New Jersey.
Great. Thanks, Mike. And our third panelist is John Norman, Deputy Assistant Chief of FDNY, retired. John, thank you so much for taking some time to be with us today.
Thanks for the invitation, Bob. I'm a 40-year veteran the fire service, again, volunteer and career. Started as a volunteer firefighter on Long Island, joined the FDNY in 1979. Spent most of my 28-year career with them in our Special Operations Command, firefighter, lieutenant, and captain in rescue companies. And then the last 5 years of my career was as the Chief of Special Operations after 9/11.
Great, and thanks all of you for joining us again. After the events of September 11, 2001, when we look in the area of technical rescue, terrorism preparedness, it was actually in its infancy. We had some teams out there. FEMA had developed its litany of activities as far as providing coverage for the entire nation, but the small community growth really hadn't taken place. We did see a slight growth after Oklahoma City, more so in the federal or the FEMA level of development. After 9/11, we saw significant growth both in the federal level, state teams either materialized or became more solvent, and then even smaller teams in the communities started to pop up from location to location. Just to kind of get things started off today, let's go back in time, take a look where basically was your department's focus as far as terrorism preparedness or technical rescue prior to the events of September 11th. The one advantage I think we have today as well with that thought in our panel, Chief Norman coming from an extremely or the largest fire department in our nation, which has had a long tenure of investment of time and resources into this field, and then different areas that may have been more growth curve type of relationships after the event. So why don't we start out with you, Chief Norman, give us a little bit of the background of where you were prior to that.
Well, the New York Fire Department, as you said, has had dealings with terrorism going back into the 20s. We've had terrorist bombings on Wall Street back in the 20s, through a wave of terrorist bombings in the 60s and 70s, the Weathermen and the FALN, Puerto Rican Nationalist Terrorist Group. And then, obviously, since the early 90s, starting with the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, continuing attacks and plots throughout the 90s into the 2000s, and culminating in the last successful attack in 2001. There are continuing ongoing attacks. So our preparedness was substantial prior to September 11th. We were fortunate. We had several visionary officers, Ray Downey and Jack Fanning among them. They had previously testified before Congress of the danger to our cities from terrorism and strove to increase federal awareness in the 1990s. In the New York Fire Department back in 98, we recognized the threat of biological and chemical terrorism was growing and had expanded our capabilities in that area tremendously. Prior to that, we had had one hazmat company, for example, for the whole city of New York. In 98, we expanded and included 8 additional hazmat technician companies. We've since expanded that even further, and we'll get into some of those later on. But yeah, our awareness has been such for a long time that we need to be prepared, and we've taken steps, and since 9/11 we've certainly increased those steps dramatically.
Great. And Chief Bauer, how is Montgomery County's focus back in the early 2000 era compared to today?
Well, Montgomery County borders Washington, D.C., and just like New York City, Washington, D.C. has obviously been a target of much of the same type of activity. And I got to say that we had also some very visionary and engaged people, and we were pretty well prepared for types of events that may occur, not for all, but certain types of events. As a matter of fact, one of the things that occurred very early in my career, as I was a technician driver operator driving the engine company, we actually responded to 2 abortion clinic bombings in our first due area, which were some of the first as related to abortion, anti-abortion clinic bombings. And that was an eye-opener, because one of the things that occurred in that one particular incident that we responded to, there was a second device, and the device was for us. It did not detonate, but that's one of the things that really has been an extreme carryover in terms of a lesson learned from back, if you will, prior to 2011 to today, where we didn't even think of that then, but now we have to be prepared, and it's not even that. Is it going to happen? It is going to happen. So we were very prepared. We're more prepared now. A lot of lessons learned from New York City, from all the other Oklahoma bombing, you name it. And Chief Norman, you mentioned Ray Downey. I had the most honorable pleasure to work with him in Oklahoma City side by side. And what a phenomenal asset to the nation's fire and EMS service as it relates to preparedness going forward. You're absolutely right. What a great visionary.
You know, and that's an excellent comment, and accolade to share towards Chief Downey as someone now that his sons are taking that legacy on and helping carry FDNY into its current status and into the future with it. So we see a lot of people, even though technical rescue is one of the newer niche markets of the fire rescue service, we've already developed some really iconic figures in here, people who gave their whole careers to getting us to where we're at today. Mike is a long-term member of Task Force 1 in New Jersey. Where were you guys back in that era, early 2000s?
I was with the fire department. I mean, the fire department and the task force as a whole, we combine them both, have always maintained a very high state of readiness. We're fortunate in the fact that I'm with a fire department that's always been progressive on the side of tech rescue. I think a lot of departments after September 11th, they kind of opened their eyes to the aftermath or the destruction, that's caused by such attacks, and made them think, wow, we're not really prepared for this. But fortunately, our department always had very strong leadership that kind of was interchangeable between the task force and our department, because they rode, on both seats. So we benefited that way, because it was always very high on our list. So over the years, even after 9/11, our program has expanded. We've picked up hazmat and different components like that, and the training has just gotten more progressive as the years have gone on.
So we can definitely see a pretty significant evolution of the process to where we are today, and obviously we're targeting for the future. I think one of the things with terrorism preparedness, especially in the area of technical rescue. You're preparing for the inevitable in its own way, depending on the community that hits. Prior to today's session, one of the individuals here at the show with us was telling us about a news feed he had just received about an activity taking place in Germany. So this is a global issue we're dealing with. As we start to develop our teams, just a couple of little sound bites on what are some of the big significant growths you've seen within your own communities post 9/11, and how they're enhancing your ability to perform today as compared to yesterday. Why don't we start this one off with you, Chief Bowers?
I think one of the huge benefits that we're experiencing now is in the National Capital Region, the collaboration, the relationships that have been built, and the interoperability that it's seamless. We run into Washington, D.C., and the only thing that's different is the patch on the side of the uniform, if you will. We're all talking the same language. We're all using the same, if you will, type of training and equipment. And we have, even in the National Capital Region, a policy and procedure on certain types of events that could occur so that we're all operating off the same page. And I think that's one of the huge lessons learned, certainly, from New York City, from Oklahoma, from the Pentagon, you name it. Those things have been just tremendous in terms of how we're prepared now. And again, you want to say you're prepared for everything. You're not, but you're better prepared is what I've always said.
Yeah, we're moving forward, which is the big element of success. I think a lot of times in the fire service, we have a tendency to stand still occasionally. And, the old adage, when you're in neutral, you're actually getting past because everyone else is moving forward. And in this case, we don't want those who plan on raising a level of harm to our communities to have the upper hand, if at all possible. Mike, how have you seen the growth of your team?
I think the Chief hit the nail on the head there as far as the interoperability. I mean, I think no matter how big you are, I mean, you could be like FDNY, the biggest department in the country, and at some point you may need some help. And I think people saw that, departments saw that after 9/11, and the country and the world as a whole came together to help out, a department, a city that was in distress. And I think that carried over, from a disaster came some good out of it, in the fact that a lot of departments received identical training. A lot of departments joined forces together to make bigger teams, to make a stronger force. That should something happen like that again, whether it's large or small, you have departments from different counties, different states, open their arms up. We want to help. We have the training you do. Bring us in.
Yeah, definitely interoperable capabilities, both in the planning, the management side, and standardized equipment. So when we get there, it's not like going into a hardware store and trying to find 50 different tools to do the same job. Chief Norman, how's it impacted your folks in New York City post 9/11?
Well, certainly the preparedness level has multiplied, many fold. And the awareness level, after the 93 bombing, certainly people were well aware of the issues. The 2001 attack certainly made everybody aware of the target phase, but people in some areas of the city, for example, didn't anticipate that they would be at the focus of the problem, that it would always be in a Manhattan business district. And now everyone is very clearly, they understand that it could happen anywhere in the city, and if it happens anywhere, any unit in the city could be part of it, as well as our responding partners, the neighboring communities and mutual aid units and so on. So the awareness level is there. What has really helped, I think, is FEMA's insistence on regionalization. The DHS, doesn't want to duplicate every service everywhere in the nation, and they realize that we have a limited amount of funding that the nation can devote. We can't tax ourselves to death to provide everybody with everything, but we need to build that regional capability and the ability to respond regionally and nationally, and that's been a great focus.
And I think that's a key point, kind of leading into our next thought. Much of what we've accomplished over the last 10 years in individual growth, both in community and individual department levels, has come at the advantage of some significant grant fundings that have been provided to us through federal money, state money, and various other sources. Within your teams or departments, how have you utilized this grant money, and you know, what does it represent to your current success? And with the current cuts in this funding, what are some of the proactive steps to help avoid any setbacks due to the cuts that you're facing? Mike, why don't you start with us on this?
Well, it's no secret that funds are being slashed all over the country, big departments, small departments. We're very fortunate in the fact that we have a few good chiefs that are very progressive at writing grants, very good at writing grants, and they have a really good supportive staff that help them. Chiefs like Deputy Chief Lathy Workers or Chief of Department McNamara. We just recently received a grant for over $1.5 million for a new rescue vehicle, new support vehicle. Most of the new equipment we received in our department was through grants. It was through the hard work of chiefs and more or less us helping to get what we need. And it's very fortunate for us that the money is there, that these grants are available, because I think if these grants weren't there, we wouldn't be getting anything.
Yeah, it's definitely become a necessary evil, for the lack of a better term. The one thing I hope we're not creating is a codependency on it, because it would be very difficult if that pool was to dry up to keep going forward. So it's a very tough balancing act, because we are in such a early stage of life, being a 10-plus year component of the fire service. We only know what we know and what we've experienced, and our experiences, it's always been there for us. If and when it leaves, that's going to be a very challenging adaptation. Chief Bowers mentioned the fact that we've enhanced our abilities to plan and coordinate and work together. This might be our next big goal, is creating better business management skills so that we can take these funds and these activities we have and sustain them into the future. Chief, what are you focusing on in the Montgomery area to help deal with these issues, either the advantage of the grants or what you're going to do when they may not be there?
Well, a couple of things. One is the challenge is getting enough money to sustain what we're doing. And it's already been mentioned, those grants and the funding associated with them have been reduced. I mean, you have $32 million to support, 26, 28 teams. And you know, that's about $1 million, you know, if you will, for each team, and that's a huge challenge. So the business part of it, I think you're absolutely right, Bob. That's a piece that we focused on. We actually have programmed in a program manager to manage the entire administration of the FEMA team, so that we're able to position ourselves for grant funding. We're able to position, if you will, ourselves to be able to utilize the grant money and funding that we get to better utilize it so it goes further, if you will. And the two areas that we really have focused on is increasing our equipment cash, trying to get that second set of cash completely up 100%, and the other is in training. And there's no two more important things other than the people to use the equipment and the training. But those two things are so important in terms of the support mechanism that the grants provide. But again, one of the things that just is a huge challenge for us now, for all the FEMA teams, is the reduced funding, because we just can't get enough training and equipment to be able to keep our teams prepared.
Right. And John, in the city, obviously, being our largest community in the nation and the target of one of the largest events that ever took place, obviously it's a marquee location that we use in many of our conversation and talking points. We're all aware that grants have definitely helped, you know, assist with the growth of FDNY's capabilities and preparedness. What are some of the, items of magnitude or events of magnitude that grants have helped FDNY move forward with?
As I said earlier, Bob, it's orders of magnitude our preparedness levels. And again, without the federal funding, we would not be able to do any of what we've done, basically. We depended very heavily on that kind of funding to increase our preparedness. We realized we've examined the patterns of the enemy in the past. We know that the plots that have been against us have been designed to have a swarming effect where they would have multiple bombings, as, for example, during the Madrid train bombings where they had 10 different bombs in different stations. We know that that's one of their modus operandi. So in New York City, being a city of islands, we're very dependent on our bridges and tunnels, and if they drop one of the bridges or close a tunnel, as they have targeted in the past, we've taken, in the past we had, for example, one collapse rig for the entire city. We now have at least one collapse rig in each of the boroughs, so they can operate independently. We've pre-positioned caches of disposable supplies throughout the city in each of the boroughs. So again, if the transportation network is disrupted, we'd be able to operate until we get reinforcements, either helicopter or cross-river traffic available through military assistance, and it's all been done with grant money. And without that, we wouldn't be able to have that capability.
And I think it kind of leads into one of the shows we did for the Buzz on Technical Rescue earlier in this year. We had the opportunity to sit down with Chief Joe Pfeiffer of the FDNY, and Chief Pfeiffer is one of the, you know, leading advocates of terrorism preparedness, runs the Terrorism Preparedness Center for FDNY, which not only benefits the city itself internally, but they do a great service of pushing out information where you can subscribe to their e-newsletters and help keep you up to date. So it's an example of, in this case, you look at New York City as maybe a big brother type of scenario where they're not just keeping for themselves, they're sharing with the other large communities right down to the smallest rural department in backwoods America. So we're lucky that when these funds are being spent, they're being shared as well. It's not just internalized. So no matter where you come from, for folks in the audience, you can still, you know, obtain a lot of the technical knowledge and the research that's done through this type of activity. You know, we talked a little bit about, you know, taking out bridges, taking out tunnels. One of the big topic areas now is to, like, the Mumbai-style attacks, where it's a small contingency, small arms, small explosives coming in and doing total community disruption. And, you know, the number of people in this room with the right equipment could go out and basically shut down any community at any time. So, you know, we have to have such a diverse thought process as compared to what we, you know, may have come to the table with in the past. We talked a little bit about where our department's level preparedness is today. I guess what we really need to, you know, maybe focus on for a couple moments to bring us all together as well is, what's the vision for the future? Where do we think we may be looking to move forward, and how that's going to assist, you know, in the preparedness? None of us have a crystal ball. I always use the example in our department. We just put a purchase offer out for a new hazardous materials vehicle. Like most communities, extremely overdue, but we're finally, thanks to grants, able to fund it. And I look at what we carry today on this truck. It's in essence a rolling college chemistry lab plus. Who predicted, if we were all sitting in this room 10 years ago, or maybe a little bit more, if somebody said, write on a piece of paper, fold it up and seal it, what we would be today as we were then? Most of us would probably haven't even been close to being in the game, let alone the visions of what we're bringing out to the field now. So, Chief Bowers, where do you think, you know, your thoughts, especially as a leader of a very large organization, obviously vision and the focus is part of your day-to-day life?
Well, very interesting and compelling question. And I'll just go back to my roots, you know, many years ago, John, you know, 35 plus years ago, looking at the fire and EMS service, that was our core mission. It has grown exponentially to all hazards, and you name it, you know, we're doing it. The thing that's interesting is when USAR teams were formed, they were formed obviously as technical rescue teams, and we were breaching and breaking and drilling and cribbing and all those basic things. What has now come about is that we see that even in the FEMA arena of the USAR teams, it's an all hazards approach. We're now doing swift water rescue. We're doing hazmat as part of the FEMA team. And what is now, I think, on the horizon, where I'm really concentrating our efforts, is on our bomb techs. and the inclusion at some point of bomb techs as part of our normal deployment, because what I get concerned of, and everybody sitting at this table, everybody listening, everybody in this room, is that secondary device, because it's targeted for us. And I tell you what I think we need to be prepared for, where we're focusing our efforts, because we're evolutionaries in this arena. We've done the basic technical rescue, the intermediate, the advanced, the swift water now, the hazmat, but the bomb incident or event is really what we're going to, I think, be challenged with. So that's where the focus is.
And I think that aspect of it is something that we sometimes forget, because we get so focused on the rock-breaking aspect of technical rescue. You know, we use the term, we can always get a bunch of field people. How do we fill the top of the pyramid, which is going to support it? And this is an example of one of those pieces. Prior to getting out and breaking the rock, you need to have some mechanism. I remember my first tour in special operations in my full-time career back in the late 90s, there was an excellent video that was out by the Georgia Bureau of Investigation on the secondary advice. And they had actually captured through some media footage a secondary device, and I think it was at an abortion clinic, but in a dumpster. And once again, as you hit on earlier, Chief, that wasn't targeted for the abortion clinic. That was targeted for all those folks that were going to be there post-incident. So it's been around. Unfortunately, I think many times we do have a tendency, we rise to the occasion and then we sit back down and relax. And the days of relaxing are becoming fewer and farther between. Mike, what are some of the thoughts, you know, both between your involvement in technical rescue and as a business owner with your training company? Obviously, to keep at the cutting edge as you currently are with the business, you have to be looking forward. What are some of the things that, you know, you see ahead that's going to make you or the system successful?
Well, you know, I'm a foot soldier in an army we call the fire service. You know, we rely on progressive chiefs like these up here to steal that army in the right direction. And our training is limited through our departments because of funds like everywhere else, but I think if you're in this business, I think you have a responsibility to take it upon yourself and go out and get that training as well. You know, you want to be as safe as you can possibly be. You want to bring that knowledge back to your departments, maybe pass it on to somebody else in the department, and maybe get a domino effect going. You know, our department, like I said earlier, is very lucky because we have a lot of members of the task force, myself, past chiefs, that would take that advanced training we got from the task force and bring it into the department. So the need for members to go out and get outside training never really existed, because that outside training was always there for you, you know. And those chiefs have retired and moved on, but there's still a lot of members currently there that can go ahead and pass that training on. So I take that training, bring it to work. I take the training in my business and try to pass it out to the departments the best that I can. To keep that domino flow going. I mean, I go out and do free classes to departments that just can't afford training, because why should they be shortchanged? Why should they be put in danger because their towns or their cities won't pay for the training? You know, I'm out there to help people and to stay safe. So I do what I can, and I think as members and firefighters, you have to do what you can.
Definitely, it's part of that traditional fire service, like this expo we're at this week. It's taking what you currently have and giving it to the next individual, be it the next generation, the elder statesman, or your current counterpart. But knowledge is power, and you know, we're in a point of, you know, critical mass in society. Things move so fast. Kimberly Allen, who speaks here on many different topics, has a great show where she talks about the speed at which things evolve. And when she puts the slides up and you see the reality of how fast the world itself moves, you kind of sit back and go, you know, I might fall off if I don't hold on hard. This stuff's moving quicker than we ever imagined. John, what are some of the things, you know, in the future that you would see, especially coming from, you know, so many years embedded in the special operations community? What's the future look like in your vision?
Well, I agree with Chief Bauer. I mean, we have to be prepared for all hazards, and we can translate a lot of what we do to our everyday operations, but we need to be prepared increasingly for that terrorist incident, be it explosive, biological, or chemical. when you envision some of the scenarios that are very, very possible out there, it makes you lose sleep at night at times. But the only way we'll ever make our community safer is to be prepared. So we need to keep current on the threat analysis without forgetting that we don't think the way our enemies do. And at some point, our enemies will have a surprise that we haven't anticipated. But the obvious easy ones, we need to be prepared for it. They cost time, they cost money, and either you're going to be in this business or you need to get out of this business as an organization. And that's a cultural decision that the leadership needs to make. There are certain things that we may have to say, you know what, we can't afford to keep doing that. But the ones that are, I call existential threats, they threaten our very existence, we need to be prepared for. Again, the chemical, the biological, some of those scenarios are absolutely, we can't afford not to be prepared for. We can't afford to say, well, we're just not going to do that.
And I think it's a key point where keeping that broad spectrum of thought in there with the various components of a Seaburney attack out there, real. Chief Bowers talked a little bit about, you know, the hazmat interface that's so much more active now than it was in the past. I remember in the early years of a USAR type of team, the hazmat guys were basically the ones that had the vacuum cleaner and dusted you off when you came out of the pile to make sure you didn't get the hotel dirty. I mean, it was an entirely different focus. Now, downrange monitoring, things of that nature. Once again, technology has been our friend. As we, everybody in the room or a majority sit with a smartphone in their hand where they can communicate with the world instantly. These technologies have also transferred into the fire service, the response community. So we're living in a good time where some of the, you know, the features of what society has available to them are also available to us in the response community. So that's helped a lot. We talked a little bit about maintaining these skills, or you know, as you mentioned, Chief Norman, if you're going to do it, you're going to do it right. But if you're going to be in the business halfway, maybe you need to decide to get out of the business. And I think that's a very difficult choice for a department or a regional leader or an organization, because we're very A-type personalities in the fire service. So to admit that you can't do something wholeheartedly is, you know, not easy. I'm going to lead into Chief Bowers on this, so I want to kind of temper it so it doesn't seem like an attack on management. But how do you handle this?
Well, first of all, you know, the thing that we need to do and to focus on in the entire nation's fire and EMS service is trying to prevent anything from happening at all. That's and the key is intelligence, it's education, it's collaboration, etc. But inevitably, something's going to happen, and we have to realize that. And the key, I've firmly believe, and our department is completely focused on this, is you got to train. That's the key to this. It goes back to what Chief Norman just said. You know, you got a core mission. There's no question in the fire and EMS service. We deliver that service. When the 911 call does happen, that's what we go do, and we do it every minute, every hour, every day of year. But at the same time, we are in this business of first responders, so we have to be prepared. And the way to be prepared is through training. And one of the things that I am committed to, especially in the position I'm in, if you will, is at identifying special ops stations that can do both. One is deliver that core mission on a day-to-day basis. The other is be prepared through training at the station level so that when those events occur, they're ready. And it brought up a very good point about passing on, you know, this training, this education, this skill. That is so important, because at the special ops stations, they train on and off duty. This is where the funding comes in. Don't have enough funding, so we have to, you know, do it on duty, which is good. But they pull in other people so that instead of having 10 people learning a skill, now you have 20. And I think that's the preparedness, that's the training piece, that's our focus, that's where the leadership in the nation's fire and EMS service needs to be, is get the guys and girls, our troops, the training and the equipment and the time and the funds to do what they need to do, because they're going in. Just like at, you know, the Twin Towers, they're going in. Just like at the Pentagon, they're going in. Just like whatever occurs next, they're going in. So let's train them, let's equip them, let's get the funding that they need, and let's make sure that they know that we're out in front of them and behind them to support them.
And perfect segue into using as an example for how that thought process has been successful. We look at the semi-recent Times Square situation with the potential car bombing there. You read all of the post-event print on that. Much of the success was due to what the first in companies did, and it wasn't just fire, but it was another example of something that's relatively new to a lot of departments: interagency cooperation. Law enforcement and fire melded together when that incident kicked off, and it was successful because they played well in the sandbox, and they took what they had learned in previous classroom and field training sessions and put it into action. So it was one of those things where you can't do anything more than validate the hours, the dollars, and everything spent by that type of an activity. Like with that, you know, you talked about multiple training points. Is the task force available in a training component for, you know, other departments in the area, or is it more of the embedded members who take and share what they learn?
It's a little bit of both now. The task force trains a lot of the WASA teams out in the outreaches, different counties and stuff like that. But a lot of the members of those teams are a lot of instructors who bring them back to their departments. You know, some of the best stuff I ever learned, some of the things that really changed my life, I learned from the salty guys in the fire department, the guys that sat down and said, kid, this is how things are done. And you respected them and you listened to them. And they steered that car for me for a while, and they put me in some really good directions. And we need to rely on each other. We were talking about relying on training and how you have to be either in it or out of it. And this is the kind of game. You're either in 100% or you're not. And like Bob said, we all have that type A personality. We're not quitters. We can't quit. You can't go to a scene, see something, and say, I can't do that. I can't do that. There is no I can't. So if you're not in it 100%, you just kind of walk away or make that decision because you need that commitment.
If I can, I would like to just interject that we are the type A personality. We are going to be called to the scene, but there are times when we need to be able to say, we can't do this, and we need to walk away. We need to make that crystal clear to our people. And at times, it may be done beforehand. If you're not getting the resources, you need to make a crystal clear decision that we're not going to do this anymore. Back when I was a captain in the mid-90s, we were our tech rescue. We were doing scuba rescue as part of it, and it wasn't being properly funded. Just it got to the point where we were going to have somebody hurt if we didn't have great influxes of money to improve our gear. And I basically went to our juvenile department and told them that, and they said, all right, what do you want to do? I says, at this stage, if you don't give me more money, I want out. I don't want to be doing scuba rescue anymore. And it was okay. I had to go back and look for the money, and in that case, they elected that it was doable. They found the money and made that happen. But just because you've committed to a program doesn't mean that you're getting the resources to keep it going. And at that point, somebody has to draw a line and say, we're not going to do that anymore unless we're going to get somebody hurt.
And I think that's important to have that dynamic and strong leadership team, either at the mid-level, mid-management, at the company, or the command level, communicating upwards to senior staff and the policymakers, because many times, you know, we look at what we're doing in the technical rescue field as a focal point, where a chief of a department or a commissioner is looking at the whole thing, and you're just, you know, one blip on their radar. So advocacy for the program is key too. Many times in the fire service is a very humble profession, so you see many events where things took place that you knew what type of training it took to get that incident mitigated. But the soundbite that meets the local news or even at the CNN level is, well, you know, it's just another jab. We came, we saw, we conquered, we left. So we're, through our humility, downplaying the efforts and the investments of both time and equipment. So, you know, as Chief Norman said, you have to have that strong voice. In this case, he was advocating for better equipment and better training for a aspect of it. The other part is, you know, the public information component of what we do. If others don't know what you're doing, you're not needed. You're an assumption that just these things happen. For marketing your programs and that, obviously at the FEMA level, it's more global. We have our two international teams, one based out of the Virginia area, one based out of Los Angeles, and then our other teams that are more nationalized but also available to go around the world to assist others. Is there anything special you guys do with your team in the Montgomery area to help, you know, let the community know and basically build relationships?
Excuse me. We actually do kind of an open house where we, excuse me, showcase all the components of our USAR team. And what's usually a pretty good draw, believe it or not, are the dogs. You know, they just really, you know, draw a lot of the attention as to what occurs on a daily basis with technical rescue. But some of the other things that really are a big draw, people don't realize the equipment that the guys and girls use and the skill that it takes to use that. So showcasing on a yearly basis, which we do, to the public, the other thing that we do very, very well, and I think other teams do, is we have what we call a political showcase day, and we bring our elected officials in and say, here's how we're prepared. Here's the investments that you've made. Here's the results. You know, here are the deployments we've been on. Here's the things that we've been able to do on a local level, state, regional, and a national level. And that's always good because it goes back to what Chief Norman said, and I wholeheartedly agree. Mike, what you said too is either you're in or you're not. And the only way you're in is if you're adequately and properly funded and then the training occurs. So those are some of the things that we try to do is showcase the USAR asset and other assets in the department on a yearly basis.
And it's one of those where, you know, you're utilizing, you know, your internal knowledge to educate those who make the decisions or potentially fuel the grant streams, the funding streams, whether it's grant or just general funding, whether at the local level or all the way up to Washington, D.C. If we're not talking to them and informing them of our need, someone else's need will be there. Obviously, lobbying is the way of success on Capitol Hill. John, what are some of the things over your career that, you know, you talked a little bit about going to them over the scuba issue? Any other areas that, you know, you saw or that the department's currently doing to help keep, you know, the knowledge of the value you bring to the table in the eyes of the local leadership?
Well, I can't speak for what they're currently doing. I am retired several years now, so I can't address that issue. We've recognized for many years the importance of making allies of everybody that can affect us, from the local politician to the press to the community groups, and try to keep our presence and capabilities in the forefront. If we've had Representative Peter King, who's the chairman of the House Homeland Security Subcommittee, we've met with him, discussed our needs and so on. He's very supportive. He understands the importance of being prepared to this nation's security. At one point, he asked his counterpart on the House Homeland Security Subcommittee, the Democratic Representative Benny Thompson from Mississippi, didn't have as much of an exposure. He was from a rural area in Mississippi, but he was a ranking Democratic member. He asked if we could do a dog and pony show, a full-blown exercise. We did a subway attack exercise in New York City with Chairman Thompson later on. He became the chairman of the Homeland Security Subcommittee. Did the full-blown dog and pony show for him. I mean, put a couple of hundred firefighters out doing an exercise in a subway simulator that we have in our training academy. And he got the picture. Without seeing all that, all he saw was all this money going down a black hole and not knowing what they were getting for it. You know, he saw parts and pieces of equipment and so on, but he had never seen the way they interact as a whole on a large-scale event. Well, that was a training mission for us. We got our people training at it. They got out to do that event for them, but it was also a PR event that when Mr. Thompson became the chairman, he had that knowledge, and he was still very supportive. So you need to make sure that everybody in your community who benefits from your agency understands the importance of that.
And that's key. Knowledge is power, and the more others know of what we bring to the table and provide for their benefit, the more apt to embrace us they will be instead of looking at it as a financial burden. Definitely you're using the right tools, bringing the political people in, showing them, and perfect example, everything has multiple points of value to it. In this case, you were doing the marketing component per se, but at the exact same time, you were deeply entrenched in a very high-end quality training mission. So you're walking away with so many different pluses from one single, you know, touch point. Mike, what are some of the things you might have experienced or seen in this area?
Our department, it pretty much has an open policy. If you need us, we'll come. You know, we're one of the larger cities in our area. We border Newark, around that area of Jersey. And we work hand-in-hand with a lot of departments around us. There's a lot of smaller departments around us that need the resources, both in our county and out of our county. And, you know, if they need help, we'll come. It's as simple as that. We'll share our resources, share our knowledge, and do what we can to get you through the problem you're having.
And good example was just a little over a year ago, had a situation with the parking garage collapse in the New Jersey area where part of the task force responded and assisted. Just happened to be, we had a couple folks from the New Jersey task force here on site last year, had the opportunity to sit down, do a segment with them, and it brought into the effect of how quick it could be mobilized. And the fire service, the one thing the non-technical rescue people have a tendency of forgetting is we're traditionally a single operational period type of organization. We come in, the fire's burning, we put it out, we go back. Usually, unless it's a shift change, it involves one core group of individuals. These events can be multiple hours or multiple days, in some cases multiple weeks. So the sustainability and the volume of resources it takes is another example that goes unnoticed by the local population, and doing the things Chief Norman talked about by putting on a display. You know, your elected official looks at this entire tractor trailer full of tents, sleeping bags, cots, so on and so forth, and it's kind of like decadent in their eyes, like, boy, you guys are pretty elaborate. You're taking good care of yourself, not realizing, because what they see too is a little soundbite on their evening news. The house was on fire. The firemen showed up. The fire went out. So all of this, you know, conversation and advocation for educating others, I think, is going to be a big way of keeping our terrorism preparedness moving forward. As we move through here, any questions from the audience or input? You have a number of folks here. If there's anything you want to share with the panelists, questions of them, also feel free to you know, interject them as we go through here as well. Anything? What we'll do is we'll move through. If you have something, you know, feel free to speak up as we go along. Kind of as we get near the, you know, the latter portions of today's recording, we're kind of trying to bring things together and just touch on each one of our speakers today of, you know, something of relevance that, you know, you see as part of where we're at, or just some little secondary or sidebar inject that you can add that's going to give everybody a little bit more than what they walked into or turned on to the session to learn. We'll start with you, Chief Bowers.
Just a couple of short things. One is you got to continue to train. No matter what your mission is, and we know what the mission of Fire and EMS is, but in special ops as well as the Fire and EMS service, you got to train. The other is cross-training. That is so critically important. And the FEMA teams are now getting into that with hazmat and swift water, all right, and bomb techs in the future, et cetera. Cross-training is so important. That's that sharing of information across lines. The other thing is, what's been talked about here earlier, is lessons learned. We have to take the lessons learned and educate ourselves what has happened so that we can then provide the training, the equipment, and the resources necessary to prepare ourselves for what may be on the horizon coming down the road. So those are the things, I think, that we really need to begin to focus our energy and our efforts on.
I think that's a good idea. With the lesson learned concept, you know, why go out and reinvent the wheel? If it happened in Montgomery County and we can take tidbits from your after-action reports and different things we can pull from the media related to it, it's also going to be one step further ahead than we were when we started, and an excellent learning tool. Going back to that, you know, training is perpetual mindset. It gives us the ability to keep focusing and bringing fresh activities to the table. Our longer-term members, many of the comments we get, well, we've done that a number of times. This is an opportunity to maybe do it a little bit different than you did the day before and to improve upon it. Mike, thoughts from you as we start to wrap up?
You know, I think you need to design sustainable training. Your training can't be boring. You know, if you want to bring your guys in, you want to keep the interest going, you need to make it exciting, whatever the topic may be. And cross-train with other departments in your area. If one department does swift water and you don't, get together with them. Take an awareness class. Get a feel for what they do. Bring them on as a resource, and vice versa. One of the benefits of being a member of New Jersey Task Force One is, you know, I'm a rescue specialist, but I could train with any other component. If I want to train with the swift water component, I can. The search component, the hazmat, the medical, it's carte blanche. I could train with whoever I want. So if you could adapt that mentality, bring it back to your departments, and spread it out amongst your towns or your counties, I think eventually everybody's training level is going to come up. Share your knowledge, share your skills, and you'll all grow together.
It's definitely so important, you know, the sharing aspect, you know, passing it on.
You got to look out for each other is what it comes down to.
Most definitely. Jen, any thoughts?
One of the things, in addition to the regionalization, to making sure that, you know, our groups prepare, as Mike just mentioned, okay, you know, pick something that you're area doesn't have, all right? If somebody else already does swift water, don't duplicate that service. You know, maybe you'll do hazmat, or you'll do trench, or you'll do high angle, whatever the voids are. But something that's worked very well for us is the need to have a tiered approach. We don't need everybody, for example, to be hazmat technicians. We need certain capabilities. One of the things that we've developed, certainly since 9/11, we have about a dozen hazmat technician companies within the fire department. We know that in the event of a large-scale incident, those 12 companies, 72 members, are not going to be enough to do a lot of other missions. So we've gotten our other line units available. They don't need to be trained to the hazmat technician level. They need to be able, for example, to wear a level A protective suit in a hot environment just to do rescue. So we trained like 29 ladder companies as SOC support ladder companies and another 25 as just CPC companies. That's all they do is they'll go in, put a suit on, enter a hot zone, and drag live victims out where they can be decontaminated by other units who, again, they're not hazmat technician companies. They're certainly not technical specialist level. They do basic missions within their capability. And we can broaden that capability out in any community as long as we focus on the results and the goal, as opposed to saying, well, we have to meet this particular standard and everybody needs to be raised. We don't need to raise the whole level of the entire organization. We need to provide capabilities.
I think that's a good example. I mean, when we're dealing with New York City Fire Department, obviously we're dealing with massive volume of both resources and personnel. But you can take that same concept and instead of being a single department, apply it to your county, your region. These three departments would be representing the hazmat truck. You know, it just changed the names, changed the letterhead, but you can still accomplish the same task. And it's another example of the regionalization approach that all three of you have mentioned a number of times today. And when we look at our funding sources, one of the first things we see in many of our federal guidance documents is regionalization. It's a buzzword, but it's a buzzword that you really need to focus on, because if you're following it and breaking down the traditional silos, you're going to be much more beneficial to the resources, in this case funding, that's out there, where if you continue to just solidify your own private silo, eventually the system is going to walk past you because you're basically not playing well in their sandbox. So I think we can take a lot of lessons learned from how our peers have done it, in this case with our panel today, you know, New Jersey, New York City, Montgomery County, out this way, and whether, you know, it's an East Coast operation, Middle America, or the West Coast or anywhere else, the same things hold true. We happen to have a panelist of people coming from a similar geographic region, but when we do the show on the West Coast and I have three other individuals here from different locations, the conversation is pretty much going to be the same. The names will change, you know. Same circus, different clowns. That's pretty much how we work in the fire service, and it's a consistent way of doing it. I want to thank all three of the folks today, Chief Bowers, Chief Norman, Mike Donahue, for joining us, sharing information with both our live audience and those who listen to our podcast. Once again, I'm Bob Duma, the host for the Buzz on Technical Rescue. We're here at Firehouse Expo. It's an excellent venue. The hot training this week was off the charts. Mike ran a high angle rope rescue program. We went out and spent a little bit of time with him, and heat was the factor, and people were smiling. No, anytime you put people in adverse conditions and they're walking around with sweat pouring off their face with a smile on it, you know you're giving a good product. So, Mike, I want to thank you specifically for your efforts and all of our presenters. So, once again, thanks for coming, and enjoy the rest of your time. Be safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.